All right, Alice. Last question ever. What are the things that have turned out to be helpful for you?
It's too
We're
sad.
getting dangerously close to advice.
Last question ever. No.
Yep, they won't make any more. All gone.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess maybe unsurprisingly, for someone who actually loves giving advice, I have quite a few pieces of actually good advice. The first one is so simple as to sound almost silly, and I've definitely mentioned it earlier, even in this series and definitely elsewhere as well. I just saw Eileen Miles give a reading here in Melbourne maybe 4 years ago, and it was the simplest phrase ever, but their advice was write something, then write something else, then write something else. And for somebody like me who gets stuck all the time, I just needed to hear that. Eileen Miles' work, very uneven, I would argue. I met
Yeah,
them,
there's
lovely, lovely person, but there's probably too much Eileen Miles in the world, so maybe,
the peril in that advice is not that advice. It's mistaking it for publish something, then publish something else, then publish something else.
totally, 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 So that is one to take with caution. Take with caution. So that's my first one.
So I think what I was saying to you before we started recording is what strikes me now, and I'll kind of give a little more context for how I'm thinking about this. I'm 52 years old. My first book of poems will be coming out next year, so I'll be 53 by then, which is to say that, my life in poetry didn't work out the way I was expecting it to when I was 23. And what especially strikes me right now is how different, and I think how much better my writing is than it was like 10 years ago, which is not to say my writing is great, just to say how much better it is than it was 10 years ago, how much more pleasure it brings me, just like how different all of that is. What I feel looking at that is a perverse kind of gratitude that may in fact just be a version of sour grapes, where a lot of the things that didn't go the way I wanted them to seem to have been incredibly valuable to me. And so I think, like, not having a job in the poetry world, because it took me so long to figure out how to write in a way that was in keeping with anything other than the desire to write a good poem. And so I think I needed that separation, I needed that distance. And I think just not being successful, not having the validation, I think, like, not publishing much. I think all of those things, in just really weird ways, or maybe not weird ways, maybe really obvious ways, made it possible for me to keep stumbling long enough and far enough and erratically enough to land in a place that for now I feel so much better about than where I was 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago.
But one of the things you would have had to keep doing while that was all happening would have been finding ways to stay in the game. Even though you were probably very disappointed to the point of being like kind of bitter and wanting to give up. And so that's part of it as well.
Absolutely. I very much didn't become a brand as a writer of poems. And I didn't, like, I was lucky too in that I had, other kinds of validation. So I wasn't like as alienated as I, could have been in that situation. I had editing and criticism, and I think those are things I want to talk about as well. But it kept me from getting comfortable before I was, and 2 years from now I may look back and say, no, that's not what you were doing at all. You were still full of shit. But it kept me from getting comfortable before I was writing in a way that, from where I sit today, looks more honest to me and certainly feels more interesting and enjoyable to me.
Yeah, God, I mean, that's one I hadn't thought of this. This wasn't on my list, but that is one piece of advice that I think everybody gives and nobody follows, which is don't publish too soon. I mean, maybe you don't want to necessarily have to wait until you're 50, but like, yeah, don't publish at 25. If, I mean, maybe you do, I don't know, like,
Yeah,
just
like
know
haven't
when you're
had that
ready.
experience, so I can't say. But and I should say it's not that I had some sort of wisdom at 25. I was just writing things that were too shitty to really get published. It wasn't wisdom that spared me. It was ineptitude.
Well, one of the things too, that the next thing that I wrote on my list, which is advice that you would have ended up following because of the nature of what you did end up doing in the editing and criticism, is this is a piece of advice that a poet called Paul Kane gave in an interview that I did with him. When you edit people, you just their voices just stick in your head sometimes. And he just said, "You have to read. You have to read a lot." And that's the degree to which that irritated me told me that it was very, very true. But you were just doing that.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think it took me a long time, even as a reader, to come to a place of being able to see with some degree of honesty what was in front of me. I do think part of why you have to read a lot is the more you read, the more you know, the more you can see and hear and experience what's there and what it's talking to and how it's resonating. But the other is that you just, well, not you, me, I needed a lot of practice hearing what was happening inside my own head to be able to really say, and part of this is just taste changing and, having different needs. But also I think I had to have enough variety to be able to start sifting things to say, I value this, I don't value this. This thing that I don't value still has these qualities. This thing I don't think is actually very good. But to just be able to start having less a relationship with the things I read that was less secondhand, that was mediated more through reading and knowledge and experience, and less through sort of received opinion.
Yeah, received opinion.
And received opinion not only about like this person's good, this person's bad, but just that this is what a good poem sounds like. This is what a good poem does.
Yeah, which you can only get, unfortunately. Paul Kane was 100% right. Like, you can only get that through reading.
And I do wonder if that would be different if we had grown up with poems being like a big part of our life, if those were things that we had a more intuitive relationship or more immediate relationship, or just it was less of a second language when we started reading it.
But yeah, when you do that reading, you end up honing a type of instinct that isn't intuitive and it doesn't come built in, but you end up being able to sometimes tell. I was actually talking to a poet about this yesterday. I gave her some feedback on her work and she said, "Oh, it's great because the places that you highlighted are the same places that I had doubts about," something like that. And so what that means is that her instinct is getting sharper and sharper all the time. And another piece of advice that is not actually writing advice that I wrote down on my list is a line from the 1998 film Ronin, starring Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro plays an assassin, and his instruction to his like co-assassin colleagues is, you know, when they're deciding whether or not they should like go for the kill, is if there's any doubt, there is no doubt. Which is basically like, if you are unsure, do not go in that building. Do not go in for the kill if you have any doubt at all. And I think as a poet, that's like, it's really hard because you get attached to stuff. You get attached to the subject matter of the poem, to the amount of work you put into a poem, and you have to learn to like listen to that little voice. That's like, this isn't actually very good. This is,
Yeah.
yeah.
And I think editing other people's work really does help with that because you have such a different relationship with it. And, you can see it in this iteration, you can see it in this iteration,
Yeah.
and you can not be careless, but you can just be immediate and intuitive in some ways that I think it's hard to be when you're so wrapped up in all the stakes of your own writing. I think doing a lot of editing for a lot of years, like actual editing, giving people line edits and suggestions for revision, I think that was like a huge help for me in being able to write, not because I had like then articulated all these principles for myself, although sometimes that was true as well. But just because those habits of mind were just so much more cultivated and so much more immediate to me in relationship to my own writing in a way that they weren't, when I don't know, giving people feedback in workshops, which just felt like such a different thing.
Maybe there's something in that too about trying to give more than you take overall. Because poetry community, which has been a big theme in our conversations, can feel so, it can feel so quickly alienating when you are only thinking about what you're not getting. And most of the time, you're not getting the thing that you want, most of the time. So one way to reverse that is to start giving to it in some way. And that's actually not a selfless act because you will end up getting something. You will end up getting a better instinct, a better understanding, more connections. Like it'll benefit you, but it does feel a bit like it's so easy to sort of take that position of like, nobody likes me, everybody hates me.
And I think too, like this is just a half-formed thought. Maybe you can help me get it to someplace more usable and more accurate. But I think there's something too for me about finding ways of giving that are insulated from my worst instincts, that are insulated from my like pettiness and ego and
Yeah, well, yeah.
self-dealing.
What's the motive, right? Like, what's your expectation in that giving? Are you doing it because you want to get, you think you're going to get something? Yeah.
And where are you able to turn that off most readily? Or at least, again, maybe not you, me. That's I think editing was uniquely beneficial in that, like especially the situation I was in. I didn't know most of these people. I hadn't seen most of them in person, and so there was something that was just kind of a little bit private about that work. It was kind of just me and the poem and my best understanding of the intentions that were implicit in the poems and the aspirations that were implicit in them. And so all of my approval seeking and everything else, it was kind of like, I think we talked about on a previous episode how one of the benefits of writing poems is that they're hard. It can be challenging
Yeah.
and it's slow and it takes time, and like there's enough that you have to think about and work on that like there's just not a lot of time for all the ego and everything else while you're writing. And I think maybe that was a little true of editing for me as well.
Yeah. If you're actually going to do a good job of it, you can't stay wrapped up in the ego side of it completely. Like you have to focus on the words. Yeah, but this reminds me of another piece of advice, which I'm pretty sure I mentioned on a previous episode, but I do want to mention again, which is, again, not from a poet, but from another podcaster who I've been listening to for like 15 years. I think I mentioned Merlin on a recent episode. But yeah, Merlin Mann says being creative is about doing the same thing repeatedly without regard to whether you get a merit badge for it. I know we talked about the merit badge idea, and I have had that quote pinned above my desk for like something like 12 years because it's just so hard to detach from the merit badges. Like, I wrote a piece about envy for New Verse Review that just went up this morning. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. Like, I woke up and I was like, oh, I think that piece is up today. I wonder how many likes it got. Oh my God, I
Oh,
gotta get up and see.
yeah.
Like, I just can't let go of that. But also, like you
Same.
said, you know, what when you're writing the piece, you can't just be thinking about the love hearts. You really can't. You're going to end up with the total piece of shit if you're just like, how do I get love hearts? Love hearts.
Totally. And one of the things that I was saying about that is maybe a little bit related to that too, is like, so much of this actually comes down to being lucky in all kinds of different ways. It kind of goes back to the how do you find your people? You get lucky, and those people are a huge part of it as well. Having friends who challenge you, not necessarily in the case of calling you on your bullshit, though that's that can be useful sometimes, but challenge you in the sense of think and see and read in directions that hadn't occurred to you yet and show you new ideas and new ways of thinking. And I think the other thing that can come from that is if it's the right people, they can make it seem plausible and credible and even shareable that poems matter. Because that's I struggle sometimes with the feeling that life maybe doesn't matter, and with the feeling that poems don't matter, and in that interpersonal charge, there's a kind of proof that comes for me that's persuasive in a way that most other endorsements of poetry just aren't for me.
Yeah. I mean, that sort of makes me think about like back to the thing that I struggle with. Like, I was thinking as I was walking home last night from this launch that I went to, I was thinking, like, I've really spent something like 4 years now trying to live in two totally different worlds at once. And one of the things that is both wonderful and really painful is that when I found all you guys, the Americans, as you are shorthanded to in my household, I found people who were super fucking serious about this shit, like super serious, way more serious than I'd ever, like than anybody else that I had ever met was, because Australians do hold everything lightly, sometimes to a fault, and sometimes it's hard to. And there's also like other reasons that I've like kept everybody here at arm's length and been a very reluctant member of the like physical community here. And so when I started to come into contact via, first of all, Josh, and then secondly Matthew, and then through Matthew others like yourself and like Elijah, I started to have conversations that were really, everyone was taking everything so seriously, and it was like totally intoxicating. I was like, oh my God, am I allowed to actually care about this, like out loud? And in terms of thinking too, I encountered ideas, like particularly through listening to Matthew, I encountered ideas. You know, that moment of recognition where you're like, oh, I never thought of that, but that's totally what it is. Over and over and over again, I kept having those moments of recognition. And then I think as importantly, when I started listening to Elijah, I came up against ideas where I was like, well, that's not right. Like, that's not it. I don't agree with that. And then had to build a more robust sense of what I actually thought because I was hitting up against this. Like ideas that I strongly felt on a gut level were wrong. Maybe not wrong, but just didn't work for me. So yeah, my thinking became clearer and stronger because I was like actually taking it seriously. And last night after I got home from the launch, we had a couple over here for dinner, and she's a poet and I think he's a poet too, and it's a bit more quietly. But I said, what are you guys what do you guys have any like actually good advice that I should include in this episode that I'm going to record tomorrow morning? And she said, one of the best pieces of advice that I ever got was in my first class in creative writing at Melbourne University, when the lecturer just walked in and said, well, first of all, I want you all to take yourselves seriously, which, we're talking about how there's an instinct not to do that, right? Because if you're not actually very serious about it, then it doesn't matter if you're not very good.
And two, like I think, and I suspect this is true of you as well. Like I think part of the reason that having that happen with a friend can be meaningful is that we generally don't think our friends are wankers. And like,
Generally,
like
yeah.
we sometimes think they're assholes, but like, that's a different thing. We're probably not friends with them if we think they're wankers. And so there is something about like taking things seriously that really, can be pretentious and wankerish. And so I think it also matters that like you have people who are showing you that seriousness in a way that doesn't feel stupid, because it can be stupid. It can, like,
Yeah, it can
honestly,
be
like
insufferable.
a lot of poetry podcasts in their earnestness make me feel like poetry isn't very important.
Savagest take ever from Jonathan.
Yeah,
Love
that's
it.
about as spicy as I get.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, for real. Like, that is such a quick way to lose faith in the whole enterprise, is to turn on insert name of podcast here. Yeah, I like that distinction between, like, your friend can be an asshole, but they can't be a wanker. That's
Not
nice.
in your eyes. I mean, they may very well be a wanker, but like you
Yeah.
probably don't see that.
Yeah, you have to be a wanker in exactly the same direction. Otherwise, yeah, you're going to notice it.
Yeah. Or they're like wanking in your blind spot or something.
That's
Sorry.
excellent. Craft advice. I did only have one piece of craft advice, and it is a combination of it's two statements that I think are saying the same thing or a similar thing. One's from Josh and one's from Matthew. Josh's version is, and actually I don't think it was Josh himself who came up with this. I don't know how he feels about this being attributed to him, but it came up in his class. You can get away with anything if you can get away with it. And Matthew's version is, if it works, you get to do it. And I think those are both great because it basically just like answers every other craft question.
Yeah, you gotta test it on the pulse ultimately. Like, it's the baby's milk on your wrist. If it, you have to feel it and see what its temperature is. I have one other piece of advice that I do actually feel like I want to give as advice, which is that you should learn how to write prose. I've talked to a lot of poets who say, I just don't know how to write prose. And I think, well, maybe you're like an abstract artist who isn't using traditional forms of drawing or whatever. But like my sense is you probably should still know how to draw. I think like syntax and the way words move, the way they take on shape and something that feels like a human voice and all those things on a page, because that's what we're doing really. We're writing for things on pages. So this maybe is different for people who primarily are doing like spoken word and stuff. But like, it just feels like you should be really comfortable writing prose, because whatever else we're doing, we're also still writing prose. Like everything that you use to write prose, you use to write a poem. If you can't write prose, I just don't understand how you can write a poem. And I think you just have so much more available to you if writing prose is something you can do intuitively. And so I think you should practice writing prose, and you should learn about writing prose. Ezra Pound's thing is that, poetry should be at least as well written as prose, which is like such a very Ezra Pound thing to say. But also, yeah, the prose in your poem should be good prose.
I'd never actually thought of that, but I think I agree with it. Like, I can't really. I mean, I suppose I can imagine a poet who can only write poems, and when they sit down to write an essay, they're just totally flummoxed.
Yeah, no, I get that. Like there's a shape to putting an essay to, like that feels a little bit different, but like, yeah, you should learn to write prose. You should practice writing prose.
What do you think about the whole, it's okay if you don't use traditional forms, meter and rhyme, et cetera, but you should know how to use them before you put them down?
I think there is value in learning those things. Lucille Clifton, who I was talking about in maybe our most recent episode, she started out writing formal verse. I do think there are ways that you're tuning your ear and your instincts and possibilities. Like, but it doesn't seem impossible to me that you could leapfrog that step and still write wonderful poems.
Yes, I mean, I just find it hard to like buy into any sort of you must sort of like way of looking at things. Because it's like, well, I don't know, maybe most people could, but I don't know, like it can't possibly be true for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've just contradicted that, but I agree with that as well. Yeah.
No. I think it's probably clear to listeners that we're all this advice that we're giving is like, very much. Don't let anything that we're saying make you feel bad that you haven't been doing it. Like it's all like caveats upon caveats.
There's too much in the poetry world of people trying to make other people feel bad about what they like or what they value. Kink shaming is a bad look.
Kink shaming is a bad look. Yeah. What else did you want to get to?
I think that mostly covers it for me. You sent me a voice message last night for you, this morning for me, kind of after you'd gone to this reading launch or whatever, that maybe seemed like a good place for us to finish up this whole shebang.
No, I'm
So would you be
sad.
willing to, yeah, everything's over. But would you be willing to like share a version of what you were saying there?
Yeah, I'm going to share a version of it and I'll include some of the voice note if I can, but I'm going to have to doctor it quite a bit because I don't want this person to be identifiable.
Hello, friend. I am just walking home after a book launch. Double book launch, double poetry book launch, Poets of Melbourne. Never stop writing books. And I was dreading it. And I was like, I don't want to go. I don't want to go to this fucking thing. I hate everyone. Don't want to do this. I hate it. And it was actually okay. It was kind of nice. But I was kind of just standing there tonight, and I was like, it is really hard and awkward, and a lot of these people I do sort of hate. I don't know. I'm trying to form this thought ahead of time because I kind of want to say something in the last episode about how, like, even though there's like envy and backstabbing, and so and so went and fucked someone else, and blah 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 blah. It's like, yeah, but we're in this together. It's not quite we're in this together. I don't know. I haven't formed my thought around it.
Yeah, I suppose the way I'll get into this story is to go back to my internet boyfriend, Merlin Mann, who has a talk that he gave in 2011 at Webstock in New Zealand called Scared Shitless. And it is a talk that I have watched many, many times. And it is just about being a creative person and being scared all the time. Everyone's scared all the time. And that is never more true than when you are in a room full of poets. Everybody there, to a person, feels like they are the one in the room who shouldn't be there, who everybody else at least dislikes, if not hates, who everybody looks down on. It is, it's the Spider-Man pointing meme, but everyone's like, I thought, yeah, I don't know. Actually, I don't know if the Spider-Man pointing meme is the one I'm going for. I don't know. Point is, everybody feels like a loser and is scared all the time. And I know this because I've interviewed like 100 plus fucking poets and they're all the same. They all feel terrible about themselves and their work and their position in the social scene, in the community. Everyone's lonely, everyone's jealous, everyone's envious, and so am I. And so I went to this launch last night. And like every poetry event that I go to, I was dreading it. I was just like, I don't want to go because I, and particularly because the last one I went to went so badly. I was just like, why am I doing this? Why am I subjecting myself to this again? What possible benefit can there be to getting on a tram? And as I said to you before we started recording, before I, earlier in the day, I had been at the gym. I dropped a 10 kilo plate on my foot, like I'm limping. I'm like, all right, we're going to the city. Fantastic. I hate this. So.
Almost like you had your usual terrible poetry reading snafu in advance. You got it over with, and so you were able to like
Yes, this is
not do it there.
the revenge for pushing over insert name of poet here. Yes, oh my God, it's true. The bad karma got out of the way early in the day. So I'm limping and I'm on the tram and I limp to the bookshop. And the first thing that happens is I have a very delightful interaction with a younger poet who turns to me. This person's I think a semi long time listener to things that I do. And this poet turns to me and says, oh, I just called someone by the wrong name. And I'm basically like, darling, don't worry. I've done that a million times. Let me tell you this story. And told them this story about like this horrendous episode of having a full conversation with the new editor of Heat, which is like the journal in Australia, and calling Anna Thwaites a completely different name and being like, oh, it was so great to see you at yoga the other day. Other name. And Anna's like, Alice, I think you think I'm someone else. I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ. Anyway, so I repeated this story to the young poet who was, grateful to be reminded that like everybody does this. It's just what happens. We all embarrass ourselves in these environments. So that felt good. I'm like, okay, it was good that I was here because I was able to make that young person feel a little bit less terrible. And then the reading was good, which is so rare. It was like a lovely, well-organized, well-conducted reading with an MC who knew what she was doing. And so I was like, okay, I think I'm going to, I'm actually going to stay for the whole thing. I'm not going to do the French exit. I'm going to stay in the room. I bought the books. Then I went up and got the book, one of the books signed. I actually did have to leave before I got the other one signed. But yeah, I was on the tram home and I read the inscription that the poet had written in my book. And this is a poet who I, like I just mentioned this article that I wrote about envy. I have envied so many poets, and this person, who I will not even give a gender to, just to protect them, younger than me, heaps more talented, two books to my one in like a very short space of time, getting published here, there, and everywhere. Everybody loves them. And I, when they first moved here, I was like, oh, I really like that person. I kind of would like to be their friend. And then they just started kind of, it all started popping off, and I was like, oh, I guess too late, like, too popular now. Can't be their friend. And so I went to the reading with a bad attitude, but as I stayed there, my attitude softened. And then I got my book signed by this poet, and then I read the inscription. And the inscription was like, I had your voice in my head the whole time I was writing this. And I was like, holy shit. I'm always wrong. I'm always wrong, Jonathan.
Sometimes the reason you're wrong is that we're not crazy to keep doing this.
Yeah, maybe not. That is it from the Unknown Poets. That's the end of our series. We've had so much lovely feedback from people. Thank you all for getting in touch and for letting us know what you thought. We're actually going to reconvene in a couple of weeks. Jonathan and I are going to talk with Matthew Buckley-Smith over on Slee Ricketts to answer any outstanding questions you might have, any advice that you really needed that we didn't get to. We're going to try to answer your questions over there. So do get in touch. You can reach me at my old podcast's email address, poetrysayspod@gmail.com. Send us through any questions, anything you would like us to weigh in on. Thank you for listening.